From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. It's Education Friday, and our connection this hour was made in Orange County, Florida, this past January, when 23 elementary schools announced that they would either reduce the amount of time children had for recess, or they would eliminate recess altogether. The reason, according to administrators, was to allow elementary-age children more time in the classroom, more direct learning time, more academic rigor at the elementary level. Some teachers complained that it was related to the new Common Core standards, but either way, Orange County schools made headlines. They were hardly alone. Across the country, schools are grappling with questions on how to divide student learning time. One of the casualties tends to be art, another, recess and physical play. This hour, we hear the case for play-based education and the connection between physical development and learning in many different ways. Let me welcome my guests for the hour. Cindy Anderson's here. She's an occupational therapist with Clinical Associates of the Finger Lakes. Nice to see you, Cindy.
Good to see you, Evan.
And Stephanie Dixon is here. She's a doctor of physical therapy, also with Clinical Associates of the Finger Lakes. Stephanie, nice to have you.
Thank you.
And a brief interlude, my news director, Randy Gorbin, is here, along with producer of Connections, Megan Mack. Hello, hello.
Hello. Hello. And we wanted to, again, just say hi to Megan. She's been kind of behind the scenes, obviously, as she will be from now on, but just started this week, kind of jumped with both feet into it. And Megan, for folks who don't know you, you worked in TV production, I guess, for Channel 10 and also for the U of R.
Yes, I was at Channel 10 for about 8 years and at U of R for 5, and I'm very happy to be here in public broadcasting now.
What kinds of topics do you like working on so far?
We have so much coming up on Connections that I'm excited about. I'm really interested in any kind of arts topic related to the city. We had a great show yesterday about millennials and art and preservation that was very interesting. We have a lot coming up that we're working on. With yesterday's news of the hung jury and the Charlie Tan trial, we'll be discussing what it's like to be a juror, specifically in reference to this case. Also coming up, we'll have Kevin Hines. He's a mental health advocate and a survivor of attempted suicide. He tried to jump off, well, he did jump off the Golden Gate Bridge when he was 21, and he'll be discussing some mental health awareness issues. And then also coming up, we've got some anti-poverty initiative discussion with some of the most prominent local leaders in our community, Lovely Warren, Maggie Brooks, Joe Morelli, and others. So we have a lot coming up in the next month.
Welcome aboard. It's great to have you here. And again, Evan, all part of our effort to just expand the kind of coverage we can provide. Megan's a big part of that, as are you, of course. But we need your help. This is one of our big pledge drives of the year. And you can make that pledge, make that donation, show of support for us by calling 454-6300. That's 454-6300, or a secure way to do it online, wxxi.org. If you're in the car right now, just think about it when you get home or this weekend. Anything you can do is appreciated, because we want to continue to expand the kinds of news coverage and the kinds of things we do on the talk show all year long.
Thank you, Randy.
Okay.
Thank you, Megan.
Thank you.
And for our listeners, again, if you value this program, if you're a daily listener, if you're a podcast listener, 454-6300. You're going to get to know Megan's voice, by the way. Megan is the producer of the program, but working on a lot of different things, helping us with some long-term reporting. You'll hear some of her work here and there. So that's a name and a voice you'll get to know, Megan Mack. All right, guys. Well, let's turn our conversation now back to the question of play-based education. And I want to start with Cindy Anderson and Stephanie Dixon very specifically on how they feel about those kind of headlines. Cindy, you see 23 schools, elementary schools in the same county said, that's pretty much the end of recess for us. We need academic rigor. You know, what goes through your mind?
What goes through my mind is that these kids are going to have more difficulty attaining academic milestones in making
academic
gains.
Milestones.
Academic milestones. Play is needed in order for a child to meet developmental milestones. It is a foundation for reading, for writing, for doing math, for social skills. And when you take that away, children are not going to meet those developmental milestones, including academic milestones. And some of the things we're going to talk about this morning, you're going to see how play is so important in reflex integration, in vision development. And if your eyes aren't working, how are you going to copy from the board? How are you going to read? How are you going to learn? How are you going to grow and do the things that you need to do in school? And play is important in that.
We'll be getting to that, because, again, in the conversations we've had about play-based learning on this program but elsewhere, so often you hear that kind of self-regulated play has so many benefits, and I have no doubt that it does, even just watching my 3.5-year-old. Mm-hmm. But we often hear it in the context of social skills and development of choices and decision-making. What you are actually talking about is academic skills building.
I am.
Yeah. All right. So that's we're going to get to that coming up. I want to get Stephanie Dixon's reaction as well, because, again, I'm picking on Orange County, Florida, but there are schools across the country that are, do we eliminate this play set? Do we cut time on resource? Do we have kids in the classroom more often? We heard about it last year with a kindergarten class that sent letters to parents that they were canceling a big end of school play that they usually do to make sure the kids had more time for college prep. Five-year-olds. What do you think?
That just seems insane to me. You know, to piggyback on Cindy, definitely play has so many important components to gaining those academic skills. And taking away a play or recess or gym or arts, as you talked about, it takes away their learning opportunities. And it's really hard because I don't think that there's any research that shows what taking away those things will do down the road to those people. It's just the focus on the test results and the core curriculum and getting those test results. But yeah, it's very, very disappointing.
Well, this conversation was inspired by an email I received from a local parent named Emmy Thebenason. Now, she is a mother of two children, 3 and 1 years old. She teaches middle school English, and she is a member of the Greece Board of Education. And I want to listen to the conversation I had with her this morning. She chatted with me briefly this morning about play-based education, which has become important in the lives of her own children. This is my conversation with Emmy. Emmy, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You are a teacher, but I don't expect a teacher in middle school English is thinking a whole lot about play-based education just solely from your perspective as an English teacher, are you?
Nope, not at all.
Okay. And then, so how did this really come onto your radar?
I'm also a parent of a 1 and a 3-year-old, but for years as I've gotten more involved with the debates over the Common Core curriculum and standardized testing, I'd heard how many early childhood experts have a lot of concerns and that they push for an early childhood curriculum that's play-based, but almost in a sort of patronizing sense, I hadn't really thought about why the early childhood experts are pushing for that type of curriculum. I had just assumed that it was because we want kids to love learning, so it needs to be play-based in the early years so that they love learning and want to continue going to school. And I couldn't have been more incorrect in my assumptions. So with experiences with my own 3-year-old who is getting some PT and OT services, I've learned that the need for the play-based education is completely physiological, that so much with body development, sensory system, nervous system, muscles, the core, that has to be in place before the academic learning can happen. So it's opened up a whole new world, and I think a lot of us make those assumptions, and we need to start listening to the early childhood experts.
I think you have indicated that as a parent, you know, you wondered, well, if I, you know, do this or that, that gives them more of a play opportunity at home, is that a good thing? I mean, for example, if a parent is wondering, do I put a jungle gym outside? Do I put a play set? That might seem like something that will just be fun, but what we are hearing is it is fun, and it is directly correlated to future learning. Is that right?
That's exactly it. And I'm sure your guest later today will talk about this much better than I can. But looking at where I saw my son struggling, coming from my secondary background, I'm thinking, I need to sit with him, and we need to practice holding the pen and tracing letters and cutting. And all of that's important, but it's not going to do anything until the bigger muscle and the nervous system problems are solved. And I asked one of the therapists who was working with him, is it an overreaction to put a playset in our backyard? And she said, not at all. What he needs to do before he can do everything else is the jumping, the climbing, the swinging. All of the academic stuff can't happen until those pieces are in place.
I have to think, I'm certainly not questioning the idea that they can't happen. I think they would probably happen much more slowly. If it's fair to say that they would, those kind of things would happen much more slowly or in much more of an uneven way. Is that right?
I think that's like an optimistic view that certainly happens for some kids, but I am learning that when these pieces aren't in place and the academics are pushed, it becomes the foundation of learning disabilities. So much has to do, and again, the people talking later will so much more about this than I do, but with less if the body isn't coordinated and working properly, then the left and the right sides of the brain don't get in sync, and that becomes the foundation of reading and writing disabilities, poor penmanship, poor attention skills, poor posture. So these kids really end up struggling, and being a secondary English teacher, as I'm hearing all this, it absolutely sent me into a bit of a panic, but I'm grateful that, you know, I knew what to look for. I thought something wasn't right, and we were able to get these early intervention services for my own child.
Well, finally, Emmy, you've become a kind of evangelist about this issue. You reached out to me. You really believe it. But your oldest is still only three, so I'm curious to know if you're feeling this way because of the research you're reading and the conversations you're having, or if you're feeling like you're seeing results.
Both, because we only figured out exactly what wasn't, you know, quite right at the end of August, but just in that short time, we've already seen improvement, and I'm sure you're going to hear from Cindy and her colleague later today that, you know, with proper screening and with a year of PT and OT, a lot of kids who later end up with learning disabilities in school could have had, could have gone down a completely different academic path.
And now, as not only a parent, but a teacher and a board member in Greece, are you looking around just sort of curiously saying, hey, who's cutting recess? Stop it.
Yes, I think that, I want to drive all around the county and see, which playgrounds are filled with kids. Because I would think that in a large elementary school, that playground should be filled just about all day with different classes out there. And I think everyone should be looking closely at what their curriculum looks like for 4-, 5-, and 6-year-olds and make sure that the kids are getting plenty of movement and sensory experiences, art, library, recess, all that good stuff.
That's Emmy Thevenason, who is a mom, an English teacher, and a member of the Greece Board of Education. And it was her email to this program that inspired this conversation today. So we've got Cindy Anderson and Stephanie Dixon here with Clinical Associates of the Finger Lakes. They are working with the kind of population that Emmy's children, for example, that kind of age, 0 to 5, that's right?
Correct. Primarily, we technically do the birth to 21, but our primary focus is on the 0 to 5 population.
Okay, because what I want to do now is work through some of what it is that you do.
Sure.
And help educate for our audience, especially the parents out there, but I think for everybody, because I find this fascinating, the impact of some of what we might think are the little things that start to add up. And we're going to talk in a minute about tummy time, car seats, W sitting versus crisscross applesauce.
That's correct.
All of those things. That's what you would call developmental positioning. Yes. And as you know, people who work in this field, then what do you look for? You start working with a child at what age?
As young as sometimes 2 months, a month to 2 months, we might get called in to be working with a family because there are some concerns with the child. But what we start looking at as occupational therapists and as physical therapists is what's happened in our society as we've improved these wonderful car seats that now it just snaps out of the car. So my child is positioned in this upright position, and their head is pretty much stuck forward. They can't often turn their head to the side very much, so all their vision is just straight forward. And we pick them out of a car, still in that car seat, and we carry them into the house, and their head is still upright, and then we plunk them down in that seat. Or maybe we put them in a swing, but their head is always upright.
Or now there's even the car seat to the stroller. You can put it right in the stroller, so off you go.
Exactly.
And they never move out of that one position while they're in that car seat.
And you think back to what we used to have to do, Evan, before we so-called perfected our car seats, these positioning devices. You'd have to lean into the car, you'd have to pick the kid up, and then you'd throw them over your shoulder, and so their head is moved into a different position, or they're on your hip, you're grabbing other things, they're moving around as you're carrying them and other things into the house. And so their head is moving into a whole lot of different positions, which makes what's going on in their inner ear change. fluid in the inner ear, so their ability to process vestibular movement input, as well as their eyes. Now, you know, they're looking at you sideways. Well, okay, I've got to adjust to that. And so all of that is being lost.
And not to mention the strengthening. You know, the child has to adapt to the shifts, the weight shifts when the parent's moving. So the child has to strengthen the neck muscles to be able to maintain their head in midline. So we're also losing that.
So you are seeing developmental problems because of car seats.
Yeah. So think about this. Take a ball and roll it underneath the bed and ask a child to go and get it. And a lot of children nowadays, instead of laying down on the floor and putting their ear on the floor and looking underneath the bed, will lay on their belly and will look straight under with their head straight up.
So what do we do about that, though? Because, look, when I became a parent, there is...
There was no manual?
Well,
I didn't get one either.
There's not a manual, but there's a lot of pressure about car seats. Have to be rear-facing. Don't turn them around too early. Keep them in that seat. Yeah, there's strollers where you can literally just take them right out of take the car seat out of the car with the kid in it, pop them into the stroller. All of these things that we're being told... What would you do differently? What should change?
Educate parents.
Educate parents. Take your kid out of the car seat. Don't just lift the car seat out of the car, but lift your child out of the car and carry them into the house. Move them around as much as possible.
But you can't.
I was going to say.
You have to do car seats, don't you?
I have a four.
Yeah, you've got to do car seats. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. And I have a 4- and a 1-year-old at home, and I get that it's a necessity. You have to for safety reasons while traveling. And, you know, it's very convenient to do that. So I think it's just the education piece of take time to take them out, to carry them around. Don't always use them.
Don't overuse them.
Yes.
Exactly.
Moderation.
Yes. Lift them out of the car seat and carry them in whenever possible. I understand that there are times that, you know, you just can't do that. But whenever possible, just remove your child from the car seat and carry them in.
Are they too immobilizing? Would you redesign car seats now if you could?
Well, safety reasons, I think that they're immobilizing for a purpose.
Right.
Yeah.
But they're not meant to be the constant carrier, the babysitter, if you will, to prop them in front of the TV and hold them in that position. So that's not what they're meant for.
Okay. Yeah. Before I get to the phones, I see the phone starting to ring. If you want to call the program, as we work through physical development, its connection to academic learning, play-based education, and all the related subjects this hour, you can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. So that's car seats. Tummy time now. How much tummy time do we need?
You know, and let's just back up a little bit. We started with the whole back-to-sleep program quite a while ago to help to prevent SIDS, and I certainly get that. But as back-to-sleep has become more prevalent, more of our choice for how we place our child.
And when you say back-to-sleep, sleeping on their back.
Sleeping on our backs. Mm-hmm. We have decreased the amount of time that a child spends on their tummy. And I've watched it with a lot of kids because they're sleeping on their back. They're not as comfortable on their stomach. And so they're struggling to, as Steph was just saying a moment ago, to gain some of that neck strength and shoulder strength that they need for pushing up, for learning to creep, and for learning to crawl. So how much tummy time? Well, you know, some of the things I've read have said, you know, by 3 months, a child should be able to tolerate a total of an hour in small spurts throughout the course of the day. Does it have to be flat on their belly on the floor? No, that could be laying across your lap, you know, so you're soothing them in a position where they're on your lap, on their belly, and you're rubbing their back and soothing them that way.
Or you're laying back on the couch, the child's on your chest. It doesn't need to
be
a flat on the floor kind of thing.
No, and if you're putting them down in tummy time, a lot of kids are not comfortable with that now. So get down on the floor in front of them so that they can see you. So be right down there at their level, playing with them. And you know, you'll see them start to lift their heads up. And as the other thing with tummy time, I'll throw this in as an occupational therapist. We've noticed that there's been an increase in children having more oral sensitivity, so more pickiness with the foods that they eat, not able to tolerate textures in their mouth. Think about what happens, Evan, when a child is laying on their belly. And they're trying to move their head from side to side. They're rubbing their mouth against that surface, that blanket, or that sheet. And it helps to desensitize that area. And so that's one of the consequences of back to sleep, decreased tummy time. And I get it. Parents put their child on their belly and they're screaming. They don't want to listen to the screaming.
I remember
get it,
that well. You know? I remember it well. Going, how long can we tolerate this?
Yeah.
I also have a picture of myself. And this is where I want to ask about as the parent who was encouraging crawling. So I have a picture of myself straight down on my own belly, face to face with my son, who's on his belly. He's probably 8 months maybe at this time.
Okay.
And I'm working so hard to get him to crawl. Now, I was the classic parent, and when he finally crawled, I thought, why did I do this? You know,
like it's just, we all
I want to go make a coffee, and he's gone.
We get that as therapists a lot. Thanks for teaching him to do that.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, the mobility. But should I have been? Is it a good thing to try to encourage crawling, walking as early as possible? You know, you hear a lot of people say, no big deal. They walk at 9 months, they walk at 15 months, they walk at a year, they crawl at 6 months, they crawl at 9 months. It happens, and then everything else happens. Don't rush it, don't push it. That's what I was often told, even though I was actually trying to encourage crawling.
I think encouragement is practice. I don't think that, you know, obviously a two-month-old, we're not going to work on crawling kind of thing. But if you're down there and he's prone or on his stomach and you're encouraging crawling, you're working on those skills. You're practicing. I don't see, you know.
I love that. Kudos to you.
Yeah, exactly. And I'd like to jump in there where I know we get a lot of parents who tell us their physicians say, oh, don't worry about crawling at all. It's okay if they go right from sitting to walking. And we as therapists feel very strongly that if you miss crawling, you miss vital components of development. If you think about when you're crawling, it's the one time where you have to coordinate all four extremities. Once you're up and walking, you can walk without swinging your arms with a coordinated arm swing. You work on strengthening of the shoulder girdle, the upper extremity, the neck, the back, all things that down the road work on handwriting. You have to be able to hold a pen and away from the desk to work on handwriting. So if you miss that component, it's huge.
So your idea is that a child who doesn't crawl at all, a child that goes straight from not crawling to walking, could struggle with handwriting, for example.
Could.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. A lot happens when a child is crawling developmentally. There are reflexes, primitive reflexes that can integrate during that period of time. And you think about what a child is doing, as Steph was just talking about, down on, you know, their hands and knees and crawling, and now their head is moving from side to side. And there are some primitive reflexes that make it so that your head, when your arm extends, your head has to look at that arm. The other side of your body flexes, so your other arm would kind of bring your hand up more towards your shoulder, your elbow come out. When you're crawling, your head begins to move independently of whatever arm is going forward. And that's sweet. That's so necessary for moving safely through your environment. That's huge. And also as an occupational therapist, just that position that hand is in, bearing weight on that hand, works on that extension of the wrist, which you need to hold a pencil and a pen and to write efficiently.
Is your concern about this based on your own observations? Is it based on, have we been able to see it studied in any sort of larger fashion?
You know,
mine's based on observation, definitely. And I think it's hard to do research because it's hard to ask a parent, well, we want your child not to crawl and see what happens.
You'd be the control group.
Right. So I feel like a lot of the stuff we do, there's not a lot of research base because of that. It's hard to ask a
parent. Ethical reasons.
Right,
for,
exactly.
I understand. Go ahead, Cindy.
I mean, I've been in OT for a really long time. I'm a grandma, so you can envision how long, you know, I've been in OT. And when I look at a child, first of all, when a parent tells me that the child skipped crawling, I kind of right away think, okay, I'm going to see this and this and this. And I'm almost never surprised. And we're going to struggle with how we hold that pen. And the other thing that happens, Evan, when a child is crawling, as that head is moving from side to side and scanning the environment, the eyes are learning to move across the midline. Well, what do you need your eyes for later? Reading. Putting a book right at the midline and moving your eyes across the midline to read back and forth rather than pushing the book over to the right side and reading everything on the right. And so crawling is so foundational. That's why I said academic skills. We want them to read. We want them to write. They need to be able to do that. And the foundational piece of that is spending some time crawling, a good amount of time crawling.
Before I get to the phones, Mike in Irondequoit, Tom in Rochester, we're coming to you in just a second. Alicia wants to know, if a style of crawling is preferred. I wonder if she's thinking about, my son did the army crawl for a while, for lack of a better term.
Combat crawling. That's usually the first step. As you envision that with using just the upper extremities, you're only coordinating two of the four extremities. So usually kids do that first. And that also does integrate a reflex because you're pushing off from your toe, extending that big toe. But yes, we want to see a symmetrical crawl. I know we often see the asymmetrical crawl. Both hands are down, one knee's down, and then the other foot's up or down, and they're crawling in that fashion. We would definitely recommend a symmetrical crawl, hands and knees, a smooth, the right hand advances, the left leg advances, the left hand, the left or the right knee. That would be the best form, yes.
All right, let's get a short break, and we're going to come back with phone calls, and we're going to work our way through some of the other questions you have about child development and how those little things that seem like little things, even W-sitting versus other ways that a child may sit, could impact the way that they learn later in life. My guests, Cindy Anderson and Stephanie Dixon, are here from Clinical Associates of the Finger Lakes. More on that straight ahead right here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on the next Connections, first hour, we're looking at restorative justice and a program that has been doing it for years, the impact on children of a different kind of penalty. Then, in the second hour, we talk to Brian Green, physicist, TV host, a prolific author. He's coming to Rochester. He's previewing an event talking about innovation. Brian Green on Monday. Talk to you then.
This is WXXI AM Rochester, WRUR FM and HD Rochester, WEOS FM and HD Geneva, and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Wealth Strategies Group at Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, offering financial planning strategies that are tailored to clients' needs. Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, investing in you. And the High Falls Film Festival, celebrating women in film, featuring films, panel discussions, and Q&As with filmmakers at the Dryden and Little Theaters, November 12th through the 16th. Tickets available at highfallsfilmfestival.com.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. It's Education Friday. Before we get to the phones, as we talk about the impact on academics and education of play-based learning, physical activity, physical development, a brief interlude from Randy Gorbman, who is the news director of WXXI. Hi, Randy.
I'm sitting in my W position right now, or trying to. I can't do it as well as I could when I was like 8.
I think I can't do a lot of things.
Okay, that's probably. But I was just serious. I was just thinking, what a great diversity of topics. We have some heavier subjects. Obviously, we had a lot on about gun control this week, but we also talking about childhood development. It's been a big issue here in the Rochester community in terms of the whole school structure. You had that great panel earlier this week, Back to the Future 2, which we got a lot of a lot of hits on social media about that, kind of comparing some of the scientific predictions of what happened in that film to what's
you came in now. You came in on your hoverboard, I assume.
I have one in the hall, but it's ran out of gas.
Yes.
But really, that's the kind of programming that we need people to support. You can do that by calling our folks. They're waiting at the phones right now, 454-6300. That's 454-6300. Or if you're in the car, you just want to do this later, you can make your donation at WXXI.org. That is, of course, a secure internet connection. And really, it's so important. This is really one of our biggest pledge drives of the year. We have expanded the scope of what we're doing, not only in the news department, but here on the talk show, but we need our continued support from our great listeners and people who live here in Rochester.
454-6300. Thank you, Randy.
Okay.
Let me get to Mike in Aranda Coit, who has been waiting to jump in. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi, a fascinating show as usual, and I, in line with what Mr. Gorbman said, my family's been a member since the middle 70s.
Oh, you're a plant, aren't you? You're not even a real caller. the phone call is coming from inside the building.
Yeah, but a long-time listener. The thing about car seats, look at the name, car seats. Not totes, but they're, use it in the car only. The real thing I wanted to mention was Common Core. As a former teacher, actually, there are no former teachers, they may be retired.
Well said.
But we're always teaching. The idea of Common Core is really several ideas that have been blended into one name, and the whole thing has gotten a really bad rep, because of the incredible amount of testing. And the tests are of dubious value. And when they go to the extent of teacher evaluation, anyone will tell you that's not what they were designed to do. But Common Core, the concept of having the same things taught across a geographical area so that if you move from one school district to another, you haven't lost a year, that's a good idea. The idea of having everything tested. You know, in the 1980s, they used to say, if you can't test it, don't bother teaching it. And that is so foolish. After all, everyone has had a teacher that's inspired them in some way, but maybe not that year. I can think of several teachers I've had that have inspired me, but that inspiration only took root several years after I left their classroom. So I'll shut up now and say, keep on keeping on.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for the phone call. And a lot to think about when it comes to Common Core. And Cindy and Stephanie are here from Clinical Associates of the Finger Lakes. I'm Cindy Anderson as an occupational therapist. Do you share any concern about Common Core that we've heard from teachers in the area about inhibiting some of the physical education, the play-based stuff?
I listen. And I wonder. I do. As an occupational therapist, the thing that bothers me about some of where our educational system is going is how much time children are spending seated at a desk without movement breaks. And there's so much of that. And even when we look at eyes, you know, we need a vision break in order for our eyes to be healthy and to really function well. We need vision breaks. We can't sit for hours and hours on end. And so that's one of the things that bothers me when we start to take away, like, the recess. There's not as much movement. We're focused so heavily on academics.
Stephanie, you reacted when Mike mentioned that it's called a car seat for a reason. Was that a nice way to put a fine point on the point you guys are making?
Yeah, I think you said we were going to look at some of the simple facts. That's a simple thing, right? It's a car seat. That's what it's intended for. Yeah. I think that sums it up. Use it as a car seat. And like I said, I get it that it's convenient and sometimes you have to use it, but moderation for everything. And I think that goes to Common Core. Moderation for everything is a good thing. So taking away those recess and arts and music, you're really taking away a lot. And I also, like the caller said, inspiration. I think that we're going to lose out on the inspiration. Some of these kids, you know, reading isn't their favorite thing, but being in a play is. And are you going to learn to read when you read your playbook? You know,
yeah, it's a great point. I mean, Mike, I think of John Thompson, my seventh grade English teacher, who had a passion for the Civil War. And every year at the school I went to, we had the blue and gray ball. And we all knew our roles. There were dances, there were, you know, costumes, all the regalia. It was not related to any specific test. It was a way for us to maybe step into the costume, experience a little bit of the actual, sort of the pageantry and those kind of things. But to also then think about the relationships that some of the soldiers had. I'll never forget that. And that was not based on a test. We weren't tested on that stuff. And they're... My concern now is that seventh grade class, do they still have time for that? I sure hope so. But that's that's a great point that Mike's making.
Kudos to that teacher. What he was doing for you as his student was laying down a sensory memory in your brain that now even you remember. And so we have all these senses, our ability to taste and to smell and to feel and to see, all of that, our tactile, everything is so... It needs to be a part of learning, and when we bring all of those pieces into place, into play for a child, they are going to learn better and retain longer.
You are engaged.
Exactly, and to the point that, you know, that Cindy made, you're concerned about the amount of time students spend sitting down, whether it's at a desk or in front of a screen. That was a way to learn and experience standing up, moving around. And for a seventh grader who's, 11, 12, 13 years old, that's essentially play-based education.
Exactly. You know,
Absolutely.
But I wasn't thinking of it that way at the time. You know, to just let me get back to the phones. And this is Carol. I'm sorry. This is Carol in Rochester. Go ahead, Carol.
Yes, I have a very interesting story. Back in 1966, I was a freshman in college, and my sister was in second grade and was not reading. So my mom found this optometrist who worked with students who were having difficulty reading. Since I drove her there, I witnessed all the activities that he put her through, which was quite similar to what OTPT folks do. But he distinctly said back then that because she did not crawl, and she was basically went from a walker to walking, that it didn't develop some portion of her brain which had to do with peripheral vision. So it was that left-right brain crossover, scoping from left to right, that was hindering her from being able to read, so that he had her go through exercises that used left-right brain, visually plus physically, and with a tutor, she was reading by the end of the year. And that never left me. So when I became an educator, I was very cognizant of movement, fine motor control, gross motor control, small group, large group, moving around in the classroom was so essential. So that's my story.
Thank you, Carol.
I love that. This is Cindy. I absolutely love that. Everybody at Clinical Associates knows that one of my passions, Stephanie's laughing, is vision. I really got turned on a few years ago to vision through a company called Catalyst in Learning. And I brought one of the books here. It's Catalyst, Vision in Learning, and it's designed for teachers. And it's a whole program where it helps teachers to be able to actually look at their class and determine, is that somebody that we need to screen their what we call vision efficiency skills, my ability to pursue an object, a moving ball, to see it coming at me, throwing it away, to kick that ball. Vision efficiency skills, looking from one object to another. It also helps you with reading. It's me looking down and then looking to the board and copying. And so this has been fascinating. So what Carol is talking about is getting on board with that type of learning. That optometrist went back, I'm sure, to some reflexes and did a lot of movement.
See, we're going to get to reflexes and visions next here as I try to work through as many listener questions and comments.
Sure.
As I look at the clock, 15 minutes left. I got a lot of ground to cover, and I do want to fit in more of what our listeners want to ask. Jake writes to us, my 3-year-old still toe walks a bit. Pediatrician isn't worried, said he'd be a great ballet dancer. Can your guests explain a little bit more about it? I've had trouble finding solid sources for what is normal versus what is a problem.
Ooh, toe walking is a big issue. We get a lot of referrals for kids who are toe walking. And yes, we get a lot of feedback that the doctors either say it's developmental, they'll work their way out of it, it's okay. As a physical therapist, I look at all the things up the chain that are happening, tightening of the Achilles tendon, throwing off his gait, his balance, his vision can be affected with that. So no, I don't think toe walking is normal. Do I think that there are adults out there that who toe walk and function in society? Of course. But I do think it's something that can be addressed, and I think...
Yeah, and as an OT with my passion for vision, I sometimes wonder when a child is, I have to ask the question, when they're walking on their toes, are they doing that to stimulate their peripheral vision? Because it really is enhanced when you're toe walking. And so is there something going on with their peripheral vision? So that's one of the first places I go. PT will look at the Achilles tendon and, you know, tightening in the legs. Is there a reason there? And I will look also at that peripheral vision.
Yeah, I guess I'd like to step back and say, you know, there's a couple reasons for toe walking. Mm-hmm. Idiopathic being one of them. We have no idea why it happens.
Right.
Sometimes it's just how the child started walking initially when they were an infant, and that's their pattern, their motor memory, so that's what they use. Some of it's sensory. If you think when you're toe walking, you're locking out all your joints, your ankle, your knee, your hip, and there's this thing called proprioception. You get feedback from that helps regulate some kids. Or is it a vision piece? Mm-hmm. So really, it's a step back and look why is it happening before you can treat it.
So tell Jake something that will make him feel a little bit better, though.
He can contact a physical therapist.
It can be true. Okay.
Really, you got to look at the source of why it's happening before you can treat it. So I would really have to see his son, you know, before answering that.
We're talking to Cindy Anderson and Stephanie Dixon. Cindy is an occupational therapist with Clinical Associates of the Finger Lakes, and Stephanie is a doctor of physical therapy and PT supervisor there, and answering some of your questions as we talk about physical development, play-based learning and the connection between physical development and learning later in life. W-sitting is another one. Now, if you don't know what W-sitting is, think about crisscross applesauce, or what we might have used to call Indian style. Well, now we call it crisscross applesauce. That's what my son does in school. W-sitting is not that. W-sitting is your legs are not crossing over. You're on your knees, so your knees are down, and then your legs are splayed out to the sides. You call that W-sitting, and you guys don't like it.
That's right.
You don't.
It is typical for every kid to W-sit at some point. So if you see it once or twice, no alarm. And the reason why kids do it is when you're in that position.
They don't have bones yet. They're the most flexible things ever.
Right. They are very flexible. That is true. But you actually are locking your pelvis and your hips in together. So you are creating a stable base of support, and you're also not recruiting your trunk muscles. So when you're trying to play as an infant, if you're in that position, you take away having to worry about, am I going to lose my balance? Am I going to fall over?
Okay, stable base.
Stable base, exactly. So the problem comes in is when a child can't play in any other position. When you are playing in different positions, crisscross applesauce, side sitting, long sitting, circle sitting, we have a bunch of them. You're working on trunk control. You're working on rotation, that crossing midline that Cindy's talked about. You're also working on isolating one side of the body from the other. If you're in a side sit and your legs are to the right and you're stabilizing on your left hand, now you're only your right hand is free to work. So you're isolating just your right hand to move. When you're in that W sit position, you're locked in midline. Typically, you'll use both hands together. And the reason why kids do it, to get a stable base, but some kids just have a really weak core. And sitting in W-sitting is a cyclic problem because you're doing it because you have a weak core. When you're in W-sitting, you're not using your core muscles, so you can get weaker and you don't ever strengthen them. So it's just a round and around kind of problem.
And the midline crossing is huge. So you can reach, there's an item on the right, you'll reach with your right hand to get that. There's an item on the left, you'll reach with your left hand to get that. You won't necessarily cross the midline of your body. And so when you look down the road, when you're writing, you need your paper placed at midline. You need to be able to write across the midline to be efficient and to keep up with everybody else in the classroom. So that's part of why, you know, when we see W-sitting, we see what's going on now, but we also see where it can be when that child is in kindergarten and first and second grade. The results of chronic W-sitting.
And going to preschool, like you said, your son, they ask you to sit crisscross applesauce. How can you ask a kid who's done a W-sit and has no core muscles to go and sit at circle time for a good 20, 30 minutes in crisscross applesauce? And so now that child is a problem child. They can't sit at circle time. You know, so it's simple things.
Okay, let me get back to the phones because Anne in Rochester wants to join the conversation. Go ahead, Anne.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I have a 5-year-old son who has Down syndrome, so we've been through the EI system, obviously. He just started kindergarten in Brighton and has had physical therapy and OT since, he was 6 months old. And we obviously love the services, and they were so essential to his development. I had some issues, though, with some of the bold kind of statements were always made and recommendations. I was in particular really pushed to make him crawl. He wasn't ready. He could never do it. And to be honest with you, I had therapists that really had me convinced that this was going to completely make his brain development, you know, it was going to completely stunt his brain development. And, it was essential for him to be able to crawl. And That was really difficult. And so I guess my message is just to urge therapists who are working with families who are already accepting a diagnosis and kind of going through that process to maybe be a little bit more flexible on some of those assertions. Mm-hmm. And to be honest with you, my son didn't start walking until he was 20 or 2.5 years old, but he started reading when he was 26 months old. He's in kindergarten now. He can read well over 500 sight words. So I don't think the crawling was necessary for him. But it really caused me a lot of panic. I think an unnecessary worry.
And thanks for the phone call, and I appreciate that, because there are some parents who've written to the program this hour who are feeling a little bit that they don't want to feel judged, that if their child didn't crawl, or if their child toe walks, or if they're, you know, they don't want to feel judged. And I met Cindy and Stephanie today. I don't think they're here to judge or make people feel bad. I think they're sharing what their work is informing them. Yeah. But let me start with you, Cindy. How do you want to respond to what Ann had to say there?
Well, first of all, let me just say that, you know, Steph and I, and all of our staff at Clinical Associates, we love children. We love working with children. We love the journey of walking with a parent down the road, whether there's a diagnosis or not a diagnosis. It's a developmental delay, a diagnosis as, you know, Down syndrome or cerebral palsy. We take that journey extremely seriously. And so I'm sorry that, you know, this happened to her and has made her feel that way. People that are working in pediatrics generally just love children and really have a good heart and are looking at the developmental milestones. And I'm thinking we're, you know, trying to share that this is important. But sometimes there are other diagnoses that are in going on with a child that make it difficult for some of those different milestones to happen. Wouldn't you say, Steph?
Yeah, definitely. And Down syndrome.
Down syndrome is one.
You know, definitely low tone, strength, all play into that.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
I would like to jump in and just say, you know, definitely we are in the family's homes. We go in, we go to their daycare, where the kids are. And often I find that the parents are afraid to kind of speak up. And so I guess I'd like to take her call just to put out there for other parents who are receiving services or, you know, that they should feel the right to speak up. And when that therapist is making that recommendation, again, we're in there to help. If that's not a priority for that family or if...
Say so.
Yeah, say so. And the family always knows best what the expectations are, what their goals are, and our job is to try and help you reach those goals. So I definitely feel like, you know, the parents should feel like they have a voice.
Before we lose the hour here, you know, Cindy loves talking about reflexes and vision and the way that they're all connected here. And so we've got a few minutes left. And what do you want our audience to know about those kind of issues, development of reflexes, development of vision, connection to academics, et cetera?
Sure. I think what I'll say just real quick, we won't touch much on reflexes. We've hit that a little bit. But a lot of reflex integration is happening when a child is moving, when they're playing. And so crawling being one of those important milestones that helps to integrate a couple of different reflexes. So I feel like that's really important. When I look at those things as being foundational, and then I look at vision development, and I'm not talking 20/20 vision. I'm talking about how your eye muscles are moving together, pursuing an object around the room. A lot of our vision development, crucial vision development, happens between birth and age 6. And this is the foundation for complex academic work that a child is going to do in school. And so movement is a big part of that. And here's just a couple interesting statistics. 80% of what a person processes and comprehends and remembers is dependent on our visual system. Then I love this one. I don't love it, but it's true. 1 in 4 children in our country have a vision skill deficit. Not 20/20, okay, that is impacting their ability to read and to learn.
1 in 4.
1 in 4. And then listen to this. 75 to 80% of students receiving some sort of special education service have their basic deficits in language and reading. So that's connected to vision very much, especially reading. And so then the other piece that gets me going a lot of times is there's a thing called a convergence insufficiency. And if you, Evan, if you were to throw a ball at me right now, my eyes would need to converge on that ball to catch it. And then I would throw it back at you and my eyes would diverge. It's convergence and divergence. And so when you look at kids that might have a convergence insufficiency, and a lot of kids they don't even know they have that. They're just not great at ball skills. You know, kicking and catching, we just think of them as being clumsy, but sometimes it's just their eyes aren't working well. Those kids are 3 times more likely to be diagnosed with ADD because they can't sit still. They can't look up at the teacher and then look down and put it on the paper, they find other things to do. Their eyes are not serving them well. And I have to tell you, it breaks my heart.
They're being misdiagnosed?
They could be. I can't say they are.
That's
a possibility, but it does break my heart. And we're asking kids a lot of times to do things that their eyes are not ready for. Had they had maybe more opportunity to play, or we hadn't missed some of these visual things, they might not be in this place. And it's kind of like if you broke your arm. I say this to parents many times. It's like if you broke your arm and you're in a sling, and I hand you a 5-pound weight, and I say, now get busy. Lift that up. What's wrong with you? Why can't you do that? And a child whose eyes are not serving them well, those muscles are not working together well, they can't see the kids moving on the playground, and we're saying, come on, sit down, do more work. You need to spend more time at this table, and you need to write more, you need to read more. Hurry up.
And we've got about 90 seconds left. No. You can start to see the dominoes that fall.
Yes,
then they get
exactly.
Maybe get misdiagnosed. Maybe it's ADD. Maybe they're perceived to be not attentive, not a very good learner, all these things that happen, related to vision. So we got just over a minute left. What do we do?
What do we do? I think the bottom line of this conversation, it's play. Through all of our topics today, you can see that play improves strength, balance, coordination. It integrates reflexes. It helps develop your visual system. I think if you're looking for academic success down the road, you have to play as a child in order to have those successes.
In a real simple thing is limit how much time a child is using an iPad, video games, you know, the TV. 15 minutes, set the timer on your phone and turn it off.
And one thing that we really liked, both Cindy and I, is that play is the work of childhood.
Yes.
You like 15 minutes as a limit at a time for a kid in front of a screen?
That is what's recommended.
And that is far less than I think a lot of families probably do.
Yeah.
And I've been there. We've all been there as parents where things are crazy.
Absolutely.
And it's easier. But this is just another good evidence-based reminder to think about otherwise.
Your eyes need a break after 15 minutes of doing that.
And the value of play. Cindy Anderson from Clinical Associates of the Finger Lakes and Stephanie Dixon. Really interesting stuff today. Our thanks to Emmy, your friend Emmy Thevenason, who prompted this conversation and has already seen the results in her own family. I'm glad she did. I'm glad she emailed because you have us all thinking about that.
Thank you, Evan.
I'm going to go home and play with the boy today.
All right.
All right. I like it.
Not in a W-6.
Have a great weekend to both of you. For our listeners, have a wonderful weekend, and we're back here Monday. It's been a wonderful week. We hope you think about pledging and becoming a member with WXXI. I think you'll find it worth it, strengthening what we do and strengthening our relationship with the community. John Anders is the engineer of this program today, and Megan Mack, the producer extraordinaire, a wonderful first week with her in the helm there. I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Connections on Member-Supported Public Radio.